Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, May 20th, 2016. On Monday this week, I called for the resignation of San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr. And I can't take credit, but yesterday he resigned.
Tamir Rice was only 12 years old, shot dead in the park, holding a toy gun like John Crawford, holding a toy gun in a Walmart store. It's an all-out war, and take a guess who's losing. You're not holding the gun, but your blood's still oozing. Hands up, yet they're still shooting. Abusing their position of power, rogue cops are cowards. These actors could win an Oscar. Grant these killers paid leave, while the families grieve, the communities in disbelief.
Our powerful intro music today is called Killer Cops by Remo Conscious. And it was, tragically, another police shooting of an unarmed suspect, a black woman who was evading police because she was accused of, or at least suspected of, being in possession of a stolen car. And as she fled from the cops, it didn't last long. She plowed into a utility truck, and then she feverishly tried to back up and get out of the jam that she had put herself into. And at that point, a police officer fired a single bullet, and she died at the hospital shortly thereafter. Chief Greg Suhr has been embattled over the 5 years that he presided over the San Francisco Police Department, of which he's a veteran, by the way. He has spent 30 years in that police force. There were 21 officer-involved shootings. And just in the past year, we have seen a spate of these officer killings of unarmed or armed but not threatening individuals. When I say armed but not threatening, there's a case last year of a man who was accused of stabbing someone down the block, and the police officers confronted him. The videos didn't show evidence that he had a knife, but he was suspected of that. And in many of these cases, multiple shots, 15 to 18 shots, were fired. And clearly, Greg Suhr wasn't personally responsible for these events. But over the 5 years that he presided over the department, it's clear that he couldn't control too many of his own officers. There were not one but two rounds of scandal related to racist text messages that police officers were sending to one another. And the tolerance of that expression and those racist attitudes, to me, is the biggest issue. And because Greg Suhr was an insider, he was tainted by earlier episodes before he became chief, where he covered for bad cops twice. And so the message was that he was one of our own. And as he struggled to, impose reforms on this department, it became clear to me about 6 months ago that he was not the man who could complete this task. And Mayor Ed Lee stood by his side until it really became untenable with the latest shooting on Thursday. So I take no pleasure in seeing Suhr resign, but I think it is necessary. And as many people have pointed out here locally, just firing the chief doesn't fix the problems. We need a massive reorganization of law enforcement agencies, including here in liberal San Francisco. We've got to get the old boys' networks broken up. And we need an outsider, a strong outsider, but it takes more than that. And we see across the bay in Oakland, where the rogue police department has been under federal court supervision for more than 10 years and still fails to reform. We have this latest scandal of cops who were accused of having sex with the daughter of a police officer when she was underage, and one of those officers committed suicide after a murky report that his own wife had committed suicide. He may have killed her. And so we have police agencies that are out of control in this country, and the police unions and often many people in the media and politicians back them without question. And we have to separate the bad cops from the good cops. And we have to punish the good cops who cover for the bad cops. And when it comes to the use of force, San Francisco police so far do not have tasers. But Greg Suhr was advocating, lobbying hard for them. And the latest police encounter videotape that surfaced in the last couple of days involves a taser and a dead man. In this case, there are no racial issues. The cops and the individual who was killed are all white. 32-year-old Chase Sherman flipped out. He was returning home with his parents from a wedding. He had had some synthetic marijuana a few days earlier, and he bit his girlfriend. He basically was having a psychotic breakdown. And in desperation, the family alerted police officers. They were driving on Interstate 85. They pulled over to the side of the road, and the cops showed up. And the parents just hoped that they could calm him down and, find a way to settle the situation. But they pulled out their tasers. And I am a real critic of tasers. I know some people consider them, less lethal. But when tasers are applied to people who are on meth, people who are, having a mental breakdown, my anecdotal observation is that it tends to make things much worse. And the body cam video footage supplied by one of the sheriff's deputies showed that they handcuffed Sherman in the back of the car, and then they proceeded to shock him with taser voltage multiple times. And at a certain point, Sherman said, "Okay, I'm dead. I'm dead. I quit. I quit." And 4 minutes later, the medical technicians who were there discovered that he wasn't breathing. But in that 4 minutes and 10 seconds, according to the family, they continued to shock Sherman with taser blasts. Back here in California, we have dueling initiatives that are likely to qualify for the November ballot. Each side has submitted a large number of signatures. One ballot measure would end the death penalty. The other would speed up the process of executing those convicted of a capital crime. And this is going to be very interesting because the current polling shows that 48% favor speeding up executions, and 47% of California voters polled prefer eliminating executions altogether. So that's going to be a very interesting and contentious debate. And I want to recommend to you my conversation with Brian Sonnenstein about the death penalty and the bizarre ways that California has been trying to obtain drugs to kill people, even though pharmaceutical companies have all agreed to no longer sell lethal drugs to state departments of corrections. One other item from here in California, and that is that there are more than 850,000 people who have newly registered to vote in the June 7th primary. Many of them are under the age of 25. Many are under the age of 35. Let's see what it is. 37% are under age 25. 64% are 35 or younger. The registration figures are bad news for Republicans in California who've seen their numbers falling. Nearly half of the new voters, 48.5%, registered as Democrats, compared with only 17% who registered as Republicans and 35% who registered as no party preference or with a minor party. And those no party preference people can cross over and vote in the Democratic primary, but the Republican primary is closed. So there is a huge pool of new voters who are poised to vote in the June 7th primary, and I think this is what encourages Sanders supporters to think that he may pull off a big upset here in the Golden State. A new national poll published by the New York Times is interesting in a number of respects. It shows Hillary Clinton beating Donald Trump by 6 points, and it mentions, but in passing only, that in a, it says, a more hypothetical matchup, Sanders leads Trump 51-38. So once again, the latest polling is clear. Sanders is a much stronger opponent to Trump than Hillary Clinton is. And why is that? Well, it has to do with the unfavorability of both Clinton and Trump. They're virtually tied at 52-55% unfavorable, where Sanders' unfavorables are only at 33. And the favorable numbers, the positive ratings for Trump and Clinton, are in the 20s, where she gets 31 I'm sorry, he gets 26, and Sanders is favorable at 41%. So the polling is clear that Sanders is the guy who can beat Hillary Clinton, and yet the Democratic establishment is clinging to the legacy, to the royalty, to the entitlement of Hillary Clinton, and a false notion that she is a better poised to beat Trump in November. It's interesting to see how voters perceive the candidates, and the Times eliminates Sanders from its charts here after the first question. And when it gets to, is the candidate honest and trustworthy, Trump and Clinton both get 64% no. Only 32% of voters consider Trump and Clinton to be honest and trustworthy. And that's a fundamental issue that allows for a huge negative campaign in the fall and the race to the bottom that I have been describing. Now, Republican voters remain remarkably pessimistic about the state of their party. More than 8 in 10 call their party divided. Now, fewer than half of Democrats say their party is divided. And for me, that's not a good sign because, as you know, I believe that Bernie Sanders is not going to get the respect and the value that he deserves from the Democratic convention. And I think that he should bolt to the Green Party. But it doesn't show that there are enough Democrats who are dissatisfied with the party to the extent, say, that people like me are. Thomas Frank, who is a longtime pal and a contributor to the Peter B. Collins podcast, he's at it again in an op-ed in The Guardian today. He's responding to the comment that Hillary Clinton made in Kentucky last weekend about the Clinton twofer, that if you elect her, she'll put Bill Clinton in charge of the economy. And Frank just hammers the idea. He calls it delusional nostalgia that could ultimately prove more harmful for the country than electing Donald Trump. And he says campaigning in Kentucky, she promised should she be elected, she would task former President Bill Clinton with revitalizing the economy because he knows how to do it. And a few minutes before she had recited Bill's qualifications in the 90s, everybody's income went up, not just people at the top. We lifted more people out of poverty than at any time in our recent history. Ah, the 90s, says Frank. It seems that Hillary longs to make America great again, and she reminded the audience in Kentucky of that lost golden age, a budget that is balanced and in surplus. But he says that, Frank does, that the idea of balancing the budget is really a conservative and Republican idea, and that there is no plainer lesson from the events of recent years than the folly of austerity and the non-urgency of budget balancing. And deregulation, he said? He said, Bill Clinton is America's all-time champion deregulator. Deregulated banks, telecoms. He put Robert Rubin and Larry Summers in high office, re-upped Ronald Reagan's Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, and he, came back and deregulated banks some more. And he says, yes, we all know that times were good in the last few years of Bill Clinton's presidency, but it was because of financial bubbles. Now we have Hillary's word that the man who masterminded it all will be back for yet another try. What is the power these bad ideas of yore have over otherwise intelligent leaders? Well, those are good questions. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And today I want to include Jeff Lipinski, Faith Peoples, Nick Yaksich, and Bob Donjakor, who is a real stalwart supporter right here in the Bay Area. I also want to mention that we're chugging along with our fundraising campaign for NewsBud, the new fully independent, 100% people-funded online news outlet. We have raised $85,000 to date. Didn't move much in the last 24 hours. So I want to ask you to visit NewsBud.com. Take a look at our plans. Watch the video there. You can share that page with friends and then link over to the Kickstarter page where you can make a pledge and help us reach our goal. I had a video recording with Sabelle Edmonds and James Corbett last night. We'll be releasing that shortly, and I think you'll find it a very interesting conversation about the diverging viewpoints of the principals at NewsBud. But it's something we're excited about. It's not going to be some sort of monolithic idea of pushing out biased content or information, but you're going to hear from various perspectives, and that is the beauty of NewsBud. Last night, watching Rachel Maddow on MSDNC, she did a big build-up, as she often does, drawing out the point of her message, and then said, coming up, something that, you know, could change the race because we're going to see a third-party candidate for president this year. And I thought, wow. She heard about Kevin Zeese. She heard about the plans, the proposals that Bernie Sanders joined forces with the Green Party and Bolt, the Democratic Party. But no, the disappointment came when she returned from the commercials and was focused on the Libertarian Party. And it is an interesting third party or fringe party in this country. And there have been some interesting candidates over the years. Former governor of Massachusetts, William Weld, is going to be the vice presidential nominee of the Libs this year. And Gary Johnson, the former New Mexico governor, is running, I think, the second time as their presidential nominee. And I certainly welcome them. The Libertarians do advance some very interesting ideas, and some of them overlap with progressives and with some conservatives, you know, at the extremes. And so, you know, I think that it's certainly healthy. And my goal is to see us break up the dominance of the two-party duopoly, and the Libertarians can affect some of that as well as Greens, and we'll see how all that plays out going forward into the fall, because so many people are looking to cast protest votes, people who hold their noses and say, I can't vote for Clinton, I can't vote for Trump. Yesterday, an ugly scene in the House of Representatives that caused Democrats to scream shame, shame, shame. And what was at issue was an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill, the $600 billion check to continue our perpetual wars, and the amendment was to protect LGBT rights in the sphere of military contractors. And this is in tension with an amendment that was passed the night before, which is one of those phony religious freedom amendments that suggests that you can discriminate against people if your God told you that it's okay. Well, what happened was the bill, the amendment, was trending to pass. And as the time to vote expired, it was passing, with 217 in support and 206 opposed. And then, as the Republican leadership has done at various times over the years, they left the vote open and then encouraged some people to change their votes. And enough of them did that the amendment failed by a single vote. A total of 7 Republicans changed their votes, and let's name names, because, 3 of them are from four are from California. Jeff Denham, Daryl Issa, Bruce Poliquin of Maine, David Valadao of California, Greg Walden of Oregon, Mimi Walters of California, and David Young of Iowa. And in another low, low move by the far right in this country, in the state of Oklahoma, the Senate there approved a bill that had already been passed through the lower house without discussion or debate. The vote was 33-12 to make a doctor who performs an abortion subject to felony prosecution. Now, this is a new and scurrilous move. It is a brazen attempt to bring a case to the United States Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade. Because everybody knows that it's unconstitutional, that a state cannot preempt federal law on this issue. And this debate, well, it was passed without debate at a time when they are wrangling with a $1.3 billion budget shortfall in the state that could lead to deep cuts to public schools, health care, and the state's prison system. So instead of focusing on the real issues, the fiscal issues of the state of Oklahoma, its right-wing legislators instead put through what to them is a feel-good, pander-to-the-base bill. And just moments ago, I was in the car and I was listening to a radio news report, and I learned that Governor Mary Fallon surprised me and many other observers by vetoing this bill. Now, I don't know anything further about what explanation she offered. She is a very strong anti-abortion Republican. And what made her determine to lapse into rational thinking for at least long enough to issue that veto is at the moment a mystery to me. Now we have a case from Brownsville, Texas, where the federal court has only a single judge. His name is Andrew Hanen. And he is the guy who invalidated the executive actions that Barack Obama took when the Congress deadlocked over immigration reform, did absolutely nothing. And so the president, using his executive authority, changed some of the policies related to individuals who are in this country without documentation. And Judge Hanen issued a blistering order from the bench yesterday, excoriating the Justice Department, demanding ethics classes for the department's lawyers, and ordering other sanctions for those who argued the case on behalf of President Obama's executive actions. Now, there do appear to be some substantial issues here, where the judge believes that, you know, lawyers who work for the Justice Department came into his courtroom and intentionally misled him. And it relates to the timing of when certain policies that Obama announced with his executive order would go into effect and for how long. And I can't really evaluate whether these lawyers intentionally lied or whether this judge is just continuing to be a real perspicacious asshole in promoting his anti-immigration views. And I received from listener Ian Milheiser a really thoughtful piece that he wrote that's published today at thinkprogress.org, and I'm linking to it in the show file for this podcast. And he is blistering in response to the judge's blistering orders. He said, a federal judge with a history of anti-immigrant sentiment ordered the federal government to turn over the names, addresses, and all available contact information of over 100,000 immigrants living in the United States. He does so in a strange order that quotes extensively from movie scripts, and that's true. I read the first few pages of the order, and he opens with a quote from some movie that I never heard of. It's just bizarre. Anyway, Milheiser continues, it appears to be an effort to intimidate immigrants who benefit from certain Obama administration programs and to prevent them from participating in those programs, lest their personal information be turned over to people who wish them harm. So Hanen was picked for this case, and this is a fascinating angle that was not covered in the story by the New York Times. The case was brought by the state of Texas, which is centered in Austin. That's where the capital is. And they drove 5 hours to the border town of Brownsville, where they could shop for the single judge. They knew if they brought the case in Brownsville that only one judge could be assigned to hear it, and that is Judge Andrew Hanen. So there is a lot of gamesmanship that is going on here. So I'll let you read this interesting piece by Milheiser, which goes into a great deal of detail, and you can try to figure out whether these Justice Department attorneys flatly lied to the judge in the court case. But Milheiser writes, let's assume for the sake of argument that Hanen is correct, and the Justice Department's actions must be viewed in the most sinister light possible. An additional mystery is why Hanen decided to punish literally tens of thousands of individuals who were not before his court, who had nothing to do with any statements made by any particular attorneys in the case. His order calls for two sets of sanctions against the Justice Department, and the first requires the government to turn over all the personal information on more than 100,000 of these individuals. Also, Hanen ordered potentially hundreds of attorneys to attend remedial courses regardless of whether those lawyers ever appeared in his courtroom or in any other of the 25 states that have brought cases against the federal government over the immigration policies. So this is a very interesting dust-up, and there's one more perspective that I want to include here. Our listener, subscriber, and well-known whistleblower Joe Carson has written Judge Hanen. He says, I applaud your order of May 19th that calls out DOJ attorney misconduct. However, lack of knowledge of legal ethics isn't the cause of the misconduct. Joe asserts that fear of reprisal is, and he describes his own history of being a whistleblower and the failed system of the Office of Special Counsel and the Merit Systems Protection Board. And then he poses these three questions. Can the justice attorneys effectively voice concerns in the authorized ways? Are they adequately protected from reprisal? Is there an objective basis to answer those questions? And Joe argues that, he believes that these attorneys may have been pressured by political appointees like the Attorney General or the President of the United States into taking the actions they did. For several years now, we have been covering the massive problems with sexual harassment and sex crimes in the United States military and the cover-ups of those crimes. There's a new report from Human Rights Watch that shows that people who follow the rules and come forward to report a sexual assault or other form of harassment, these individuals are often subject to retaliation, and they get drummed out of the military, often with a description that they had a personality disorder. Now, this occurred in the case of a woman named Amy Quinn. At the age of 22, she reported a series of sexual assaults, and then she was forced out with a false diagnosis of personality disorder. Quote, "The military career I was passionate about was over, and I was suddenly labeled a bad apple." And Human Rights Watch reports that thousands of U.S. service members have found themselves drummed out of the armed forces, like Quinn, after they reported being sexually harassed or raped. And this is a serious problem. And people who have appealed after they got one of these discharges with a false claim of mental issues, 90% to 90% of the appeals are rejected by a military review panel. And so this is a very serious problem, and once again, we come back to the efforts in the United States Senate to address it. And it comes down to a battle between two Democratic senators, both women. On one side, you have Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, who has pushed for laws to take these prosecutions out of the chain of command and give them to outside, often civilian, prosecutors. And then you have Claire McCaskill, a conservative Democrat from Missouri, who supports the Pentagon position that the chain of command needs the discretion to handle these cases. Well, it's really clear that the current system, the status quo, is broken. It does not protect women or men from sex crimes in the military, nor does it protect them from retaliation when they do the right thing and report it. We've gotten confirmation of discovery of the debris from Egypt Air Flight 804, found in the Mediterranean about 180 miles north of Alexandria, Egypt. And what is fascinating to me is that so far, and I haven't checked in the last 2 hours, but I think I'm pretty safe to say here, no terrorist group has claimed responsibility for downing this jet. We know, for example, that reporters who follow the websites and Twitter accounts where the Islamic State has claimed credit for, say, the Paris bombings or other attacks, nothing. And yet, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both asserted, with very little information on the, within hours of the news of this airliner going down in the Mediterranean, that this is, Trump flatly asserted that it's terrorism, and Hillary used a slightly less strong language to suggest that it probably is. But I think experience shows we should wait and see, and not just, immediately point the finger and blame people when the evidence isn't there. I'm very much appalled at the way the European Union cut this deal with Turkey to give them billions of dollars to try to keep Syrian refugees from leaving Syria and Turkey and that general area. And there's an interesting case. A man from Syria was in Greece trying to find asylum in Europe, and he was one of the test cases. He was ordered deported to Turkey, where he has no relatives or no way to live. They were going to send him to a refugee camp. So he appealed, and a three-person appeals committee said that Turkey would not give Syrian refugees the rights that they're owed under international treaties, and therefore they overturned the deportation order by a verdict of 2-1. Now, this upholds what I consider to be both legal and moral values. And I want to cite Ai Weiwei. He is the Chinese artist and dissident. I shared with you last year his powerful exhibit here in San Francisco on the island of Alcatraz in the bay. And he has been in Greece on the island of Lesbos for several months now, and he's created art. That's what he always does. But he went public in Athens the other day, where some of his works of art are going on display, and he said that he could never have imagined conditions like he experienced on Lesbos. He said that this agreement regarding the refugees, it is not legal or moral, it is shameful, it is not a solution, it will cause problems later. And then he told The Guardian, these people have nothing to do with Europe. They are like people from outer space, but they have to come. They have been pushed out, and they are being totally neglected by Europe. They're sleeping in the mud and rain, and it's only volunteers giving them food or clothes. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. You're free to share it, and I hope you will. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.